Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes. One, two, three.
Welcome to an extra special edition of It's Hot in Here. I know we say that it's extra special every single week, but that's because it actually is.
I noticed that.
And it gets increasingly special with each week. So, and this week we have an extra special show, I'm going to say, and that's the absolute truth. This is Gwen Hetfield, by the way.
And I'm Gina Genison.
And we have here in the studio today a very special guest who we're thrilled to have with us here. And I guess I can say that she is also thrilled to be here. Rebecca Harden from the School of Natural Resources and Environment and Department of Anthropology. Welcome.
I am so thrilled.
Rebecca, you just told us a little anecdote about how you had moved here to Ann Arbor and discovered WCBN, and it quite literally saved your life.
Quite literally. My first Michigan winter, I had moved here from Montreal. Also cold, but different in a way. More sunshine, lots of underground tunnels, and I just was about ready to jump off one of those massive modern buildings into the Diag and just end it, you know? And then I found CBN. And I was like, you know, it's fine to be in Ann Arbor. I'm going to be fine.
Well, we're really glad that you opted for WCBN over dramatic campus suicide. And we're really, really happy to have you here in the studio today.
88.3 saved your life and our lives, potentially.
I think we might save a few more this afternoon. Let's keep going, girls.
All right. So we're going to go straight into a tune, and then we'll come back with some stories from Africa, both in the news and from our own lives. All right. right. I hope you enjoyed that tune. We certainly forgot to say, but perhaps you caught it at the tail end of our discussion, that this is a very special Africa edition of It's Hot in Here. Not only is Rebecca Harden a fantastic Africanist, but I'm also headed there shortly, as early as Saturday. So, woo! I'm excited. I'm trying to get extra excited by sharing our joy with you. So, we've collected a number of stories from the continent to share with you this week. And perhaps, Gwen, you'd like to start us off.
Yeah, the story I'd like to start off with is one that's gotten a fair bit of play in the, while in the international press, I haven't seen it really covered particularly well in the U.S. media thus far. So out of the BBC and The Guardian in the U.K., we have a story about the largest dam, plans for the largest dam ever constructed, larger even than the Three Gorges in China. It's called the Grand Inga Dam, and the plan is to construct it on the Congo River. And apparently this dam has been in the works for some years, but because of civil conflicts that have been going on in the Congo, they haven't been able to really get many investors involved because obviously they feared that the construction would never happen and they'd lose some money. But apparently now there is a peace agreement, and the seven African governments and the world's largest banks and construction firms met in London a couple days ago to plan this dam. It's supposedly going to be worth about $80 million U.S., the world's largest hydro project on the Congo River. Supporters say it could double the amount of electricity available on the African continent. However, critics say, in addition to some potential environmental repercussions, which perhaps we can get into a bit in a minute here. It's also much of the plans is for much of the electricity to be exported out of the Congo and into other parts of Africa and even as far away as Europe and Israel. So it's interesting to me because this project is part of what's called the Clean Development Mechanism, or it's a potential Clean Development Mechanism project, which for our listeners who may not know, the Clean Development Mechanism is a way for industrial countries, richer countries, interested in reducing their carbon emissions, but not so much reducing their own carbon emissions, but buying, I guess, what would be the equivalent of offsets in the developing world. And the hydropower, such as the Grand Inga Dam or the potential Grand Inga Dam, would be one way for countries to participate in a Clean Development Mechanism. The Grand Inga's prospects of being completed by 2022, which is the plan, are said to have risen significantly in the last year as countries, banks, and private companies have found they can earn high returns from the emerging global carbon offset market and UN climate change credits. So it's interesting to me, and perhaps Rebecca, you can comment a little bit on this, because it seems like these sorts of large-scale natural resource projects, and especially with the rise of the Clean Development Mechanism, are becoming more common. But from my understanding of the history of these sorts of large natural resource-based projects, especially as they relate to sustainable development, poverty reduction, et cetera, don't necessarily seem to have the greatest history of actually producing returns for the people in the region where they are implemented.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, of course, about that. It's one of those double binds that we find ourselves in. There's a terrific book by McCulley called On Dams. There are several scholars, actually, who've worked extensively to document how it is that dams and hydroelectric in particular has these contradictions and creates also a lot of impacts in societies like the Congo Basin, where free-flowing rivers have given rise to incredibly flexible, diversified economies of mixed agriculture, fishing, trade, hunting, horticulture. I mean, that's one of the things that the big dam can do, is to really transform a subtle, highly adaptive, highly resilient, highly diversified economic and ecological system into something that's sort of much more monolithic and hence in some ways much more sort of susceptible to certain forms of vulnerability. So if you look at, for example, large dam projects, there are some in Senegal, one of which has been studied by Michigan's own Mark Wilson and his colleagues, an ecologist here, where preliminary studies for the dam indicated that it could cause enormous outbreaks of Rift Valley fever and transform an area where you had mixed animal husbandry and agriculture into a much more predictable pasture and plain resource, but one where certain kinds of diseases would be much more prevalent and there might be some real human loss of life and livestock loss of life. And this, in turn, came to pass. So it's not even just about can a dam produce more wealth for non-locals than locals, which they can do. It's also about Canadam's negatives for locals, local animals and people, just literally be outweighed by the broader national benefits it produces to national elites and international elites. And this is a history we've seen play out throughout the developing world again and again and again. What do you say? You know, one thing that makes the Congo especially difficult, I don't know if you all heard the NPR story this morning on artisanal mining in the Congo, but many of the folks who would be labor for this process and whose land and homelands and all would be transformed are already struggling so hard that in this case, those calculations will be particularly fraught. It's hard to do a lot worse than many of the rural populations in Congo are already doing. And so those cost-benefit types of analyses, the willingness to risk certain negative consequences and transformations in an effort to stabilize that country and bring some other options in, may just be one of those things that we have to sort of live with. But there are certainly well-documented reasons why large dams are not necessarily the solution they propose to be.
Well, I think that is a great point. And looking at historically the history of dams and other large-scale natural resource projects, whether it be oil exploration or mining or things that are supposed to bring wealth and quote-unquote development to African nations especially, since this is the Africa edition of It's Hot in Here. But certainly that plays out around the world in developing nations as well. But it's interesting that you mentioned cost-benefit analysis because it seems like what you brought up is the fact that what is even in the cost-benefit analysis is what really counts. And it's the stability of these ecosystems and these, like, no doubt we're dealing with very poor people here, but they have developed resilient economies that in many ways are enmeshed in these ecological cycles that can be irreparably harmed by things like giant dams or other sorts of large natural resource projects. So I think that is not really discussed significantly in the discourse, and it certainly isn't discussed in the case of the Grand Inga Dam in the little bit of media coverage that I've read about it. It seems to be more of an issue of, well, are the benefits from the increased electricity production going to accrue to local people? Is it going to accrue to the people in the developed world? Which is certainly a valid point to bring up, but all of these other sort of more embedded issues that you're discussing are rarely discussed.
Yeah, and I guess the point to make about cost-benefit analyses, the points I wanted to make are that they often miss, right, some of the longer-term ecological and economic impacts over time, the erosion of those resilient, flexible, historically embedded systems is something that's hard to put a cost-benefit kind of figure on, right? But the other point is that sometimes they do name and indeed forecast some of these costs, as in the many deaths from the Rift Valley fever outbreaks in the wake of this dam in Senegal. And they just decide, you know, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. And that's where it gets really tricky. It's really a set of sort of painful calculations that, in the making of which, we often back off from saying, well, what are we doing about energy use? There's not a lot to be done about it, but what can we do, and how do Congolese elites and international elites think about those things in the same? Can we think about those things in the same breath as we calculate costs and benefits on a kind of regional basis or a national basis for Congo?
Well, on that note of elite decision making, one of the other criticisms that's been leveled at the dam is people saying that the project is going to be a magnet for corruption. Especially since the region is so unstable already and its enormous budget and large contracts could devolve, according to one critic, Inga into a corruption-riddled white elephant, which will centralize a vast store of the region's electric and financial power, a development model that can foster tensions and civil wars. So one thing I think that's particularly pertinent to be discussing here on the Africa edition of our show, and Gina, you know a lot about this as well, is sort of the intersection between civil conflict and natural resource exploitation and these large-scale natural resource exploitation projects that are going on in Africa. And the ties, to me at least, it seems that in Africa those intersections are quite prominent in a way that maybe they aren't in other sorts of conflicts in the rest of the world. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that, Rebecca, the link between civil conflict and natural resource exploitation, especially in the Congo, which you know best?
Yeah, I should say that my own long-term field experience is, I trained as a Peace Corps volunteer in Democratic Republic of Congo and in Bujumbura and Burundi and Rwanda. I know that region well. I love it well. I love the culture and the music especially. So it's one that I do know. But my real expertise is in Central African Republic, which is a little further north, which, by the way, is a country in which a lot of the energy that is generated by hydroelectric power. And I remember well the long afternoons and evenings with the lights off because there just wasn't enough water pressure to power that. You know, it's a really interesting form of energy for the region and the nation. The question of corruption, civil conflict and stuff, I think, has to be taken on several levels. One thing that's certainly true in the Democratic Republic of Congo, as in Central African Republic and other countries in this broader equatorial African region, is that the idea of the terroir in French, or the territory from which people come into urban elites, into urban communities, is perpetually important. There's this lovely book called The Politics of the Belly, or La Politique du Ventre, by political scientist Jean-François Bayard. It was written in the you know, 80s and 90s, and it's dated but still very valid. And it talks about how people in urban elites serving their nation state remain in many ways interpolated or shaped and in kind of interesting patron-client relationships to the regions from which they've come. And so you see in a country like DRC, there's this wonderful book in the making now by a colleague of mine at the SSRC, Tatiana, who's writing about Bemba. He's an opposition political leader in the DRC who's spoken out and been a rival to Kabila, father and son, and who has links historically to the home region where Mobutu came from. These kinds of regional connections are very starkly visible in the landscape, even if we don't talk about civil conflict, if we just talk about infrastructure. Who was the president during the 70s and 80s will tell you where there are the best landing strips, the best roads, the best best lit streets, the best electricity grid. And that's something which is just a kind of political reality. It's a political reality anywhere, I would argue, but it's especially stark in a place like the Congo Basin, where overall infrastructural trends can be toward a degradation rather than a maintenance of national infrastructure if they're left alone, for a lot of reasons. Tropical forests are hard places to maintain infrastructure at all, but these are also countries who've been so pillaged. The economies have pillaged, the extraction of natural resources to make markets and commodities elsewhere than in Africa has left them with really weak infrastructure. So those regional differences that come out of political processes are very real. They're historically documentable. They're contested within these countries. And they have a lot to do with the stakes involved and who gets access to ministerial and presidential power and why it is that you get these regionalized movements supporting this or that leader to the point of militias, right, that become very active. We want the dams. We want the roads. We want the access, right? There isn't a lot of confidence in this point that there can be distributive justice on those fronts. And that can degrade really rapidly, both within and across national boundaries in this region of Africa. It's very worrisome.
I think we've also been seeing it playing out a little bit, or quite a bit, in Kenya in the past few months after the election. The Luos, who are based in western Kenya, which are, the third largest or second largest ethnic group in the country, have taken up a serious issue with the ruling elites at the moment, who only represent about 10% of the entire population, to the point where there's really a lot of tribal conflict and a lot of worry about that, because there is that view that the infrastructure hasn't been built up in western Kenya because of that fact. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's not unique to the Congo.
It's interesting to me, Rebecca, that you talk about infrastructure and obviously the how infrastructure has been constructed very unequally across the African continent in a large way because of how power has been accumulated in certain hands and not in others. But it seems to me that when you're talking about these large-scale infrastructure projects that people are constructing in the name of sustainable development, it seems to me that that sort of perpetuates that inequality, because you're going to be obviously working directly with the government of the nation, the ruling elites. So it seems to me like there could obviously be substantial benefits from these large infrastructure projects, and they certainly need them, or the infrastructure certainly needs to be improved. But at the same time, it's questionable to me you know, how the benefits are distributed. And it seems that in the case of this Grand Inga Dam, that it's likely that it's going to not only possibly destroy some ecosystems, which are the basis of livelihood for people who live on the Congo, in the Congo Basin, but it's also going to help perpetuate that sort of accumulation of power and wealth in the hands of people who are perhaps responsible in the first place for making it for the very unequal situation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a cruel irony, too. You see this not just with large dams, but, for example, the Chad Cameron pipeline project that involved ExxonMobil. What an amazingly publicized and, in fairness, earnestly executed effort to intervene on the part of the private sector, right, and the public sector, to intervene in the distribution of benefits and costs, right, of that project, and to redefine the way that costs and benefits were distributed. And yet, as time goes on and we see the fragility of Chad's national political leadership and the momentum of movements of contestation and dispute, indeed, you know, I'm headed to New York next week to help deal with people at the UN and the SSRC who are concerned about Chadian incursions into the Central African Republic. And there's lots that's being written right now and thought about how the oil industry's interventions in the sort of Chad Cameroon biogeographical region have, in the short to medium term, generated new and interesting models for the distribution of these kinds of benefits in light of infrastructural developments. And in the medium to long term, you know, maybe playing into further destabilization, and that's extremely worrisome. At what point do what kinds of international communities, public and private and political, say these kinds of risks of destabilization and further militarization are going to outweigh some of these benefits for greening the world as fast as we possibly can? It's a really tricky set of situations right now in that region.
Well, not to toot the horn of it's hot in here, which we do quite frequently, but I have to say that is probably the best explanation I've heard of the intersection of conflict and natural resources and environmental issues in Africa. So thank you very much
it's
for that,
hot,
Rebecca. We are going to get back to that, but first you discussed your love for the culture and the music of the areas where you do research in Central Africa, and perhaps we can get one of those songs up here.
Let's hear a little. Oh.
Absolutely. This is actually one that was blazing up the dance floors of Kenya when I was out there, and actually all over East Africa. This is a song called Banjuka by a group called DNA, and it basically translates as, you know, life is hard, things get rough, but you throw up your hands, you throw them down, you dance, you have a good time. And it's kind of follows in the hip-hop influence here from the U.S., and if you're interested, definitely check it out on YouTube. There's a pretty racy video, Banjuka. Check it out.
Life ni fupi na misijifungi na weka shida chini na tupa mikono juu. Ba, 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 banjuka tu. Ba, 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 banjuka tu. Ba, 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 banjuka tu. Na weka shida chini na tupa mikono juu. Ba, 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 banjuka tu. Mina come through niki rap to my 1-2. Na kwenye club watu wanna dance to. Domino kwenye track majabu. Wazim sauti ya dhahabu unataka jima. Welcome to Bora sura ni nice. This I'm the bombs. Oh, najua nimewakwa juu, najua leo lazima watu wa banju yeah. Chafuke kwani nini wanauliza tutasifu happy mpaka lini? Si tuna shida zetu, tusikize zako kwa nini? Wacha nishike drinks nikicheki warembo hivi, tuangaliane tusalimiane, hizo namba za simu ndio tubadilishane. Ni vile tumejua na leo tu, kwa hivyo leo dude tutainuka tu na kuruka tu. Banjuka tu, life ni fupi na misijifungi, na weka shida chini na tupa mikono juu. Ba, 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 banjuka tu. Ba, 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 banjuka tu. Ba, 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 banjuka tu. Na weka shida chini na tupa mikono juu. Ba, 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 banjuka tu. Tutumejuana umenibamba ni aje. Situende hivo unionyeshe mtani. Si uongo, hiyo keja yako ni safi. Nikaribishe, nyosani jue ni aje. Na suna jua leo nimekam na gari.
na inafaa ilale ndani ya parking. Nimebonga mbaya, malkia nisamehe. Nivenye hiyo keji na nishikishanga pepe. Nje na ndani kila kitu ni deadly. Lakini na hopa inanga wageni wengi. Juhi game ni boka, sio soka. Story ya watu wengi kwa uwanja na ugopa. Nikusho safi letu tadu. Hizo vitu tukazikuta tu. Kladi na mashiti tukizitupa juu. Meliuma juu zimekushika. Msa ruka tu. Banjuka juu. Life ni fupi na amisi chifungi. Naweka shida chini na tupa mikono juu. Banjuka tu. Banjuka tu. Banjuka tu. Naweka shida chini na tupa mikono juu. Banjuka tu. Ruka tu. Banjuka juu. Life ni fupi na amisi chifungi. Naweka shida chini na tupa mikono juu. Banjuka tu. Banjuka tu. Banjuka tu. Naweka shida chini na tupa mikono juu. Banjuka tu. Ruka tu. Ruka tu. Ruka tu. 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 Banjuka tu.
I hope you enjoyed that rockin' tune. And while we were listening to that, Carrie Dugan, our Washington correspondent, is live in the It's Hot In Here studio. This really is an extra special show. I know we say that every time. But Carrie, as we and all you know, is working for the League of Conservation Voters in Washington, D.C., also has very strong affiliations with the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. And I know we have some listeners over there, so I hope y'all are doing well. So Carrie, how are things with you? How is it to be back in Michigan?
It is grand to be back in Michigan. I know I'm back just in time for the good weather. So
you picked a really good time to come back.
Trees have bloomed in the past week. It's amazing.
And all my allergies are here, so it's great to be back in Michigan.
Especially on the air, where your allergies are magnified.
Apologize for all to the listeners. I'm here all week doing some work for National LCV. And it's funny because the last couple of times I've been on your show, I got to talk about the presidential race, which everybody's obviously tuned into, and I've also talked about our program for the Senate. But the reason I'm actually in Michigan is because we have made three endorsements for Michigan federal candidates, and so I'm going to share those with you if that's cool.
Absolutely.
Please. Great. The first is from my home district, my HD, as we've talked about. We just endorsed Gary Peters, who's running against Joe Nolenberg, our number two on our Dirty Dozen list. Apologize for the sniffle. So I was out there on Monday in Rochester, Michigan, which is not far from my hometown, endorsing him. And Gary Peters is fantastic. He's really been an advocate for renewable energy, especially in the state of Michigan, and wants to go to the U.S. House and be a good representative and advocate.
Carrie, if you could maybe talk for a minute, why is Joe Nolenberg so high on your LCV hit list?
Well, I think I've talked about it before on the show, but, you know...
you were absent, Gwen.
Well, tell me again.
I'm happy to reiterate.
Yeah.
Congressman Nolenberg has a lifetime LCV score of 8%, and we've talked about the metrics that LCV uses, scoring everyone across the board on a range of issues. He's been most notorious for his work to prevent studies on global warming by the EPA. So he's sort of easily on our number two. He's only second to Senator James Inhofe, which is he's notorious for calling climate change a hoax.
Sounds like that auto industry terroir work in there.
Yeah, Congressman Nolenberg, if you look up on Open Secrets or the FEC, you can see who's been his funder. And, you know, it's our belief that he rewards his corporate contributors rather than his own constituents. So we're happy to endorse his opponent, Gary Peters. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so I went to my hometown and I did that announcement. And then on Tuesday, I was up in Lansing with State Senator Mark Schauer, who's running against Congressman Tim Walberg out of Michigan's 7th Congressional District, which is out towards Battle Creek. It's actually west part of Ann Arbor all the way to Battle Creek. And State Senator Schauer has been a real advocate. He's now pushing legislation to get the 10% by, I think it's 20. 2015 or 2020.
Mm-hmm. I believe that passed.
It passed out of the House.
Yeah.
Okay. Now it's going to go to the Senate, and so he's pushing for that. Another great person on renewable energy, understands the urgency and the science behind global warming, and I think he's going to be great when we get him in Congress. And to talk about his opponent, the incumbent has a 5% LCB score, so another sort of egregious record for one term in Congress. It means he voted right on one issue last year, mm-hmm. and it was not even a Michigan-specific issue. And then the last person we just released yesterday, is incumbent Republican Vern Ehlers out of Grand Rapids, who's actually been a great friend to LCV in Congress.
A great friend to the Great Lakes, also.
Yes, that's right. So we were very happy to see him return to office and continue to work hard on global warming and advocating for wind, solar, biomass, and other alternatives. So those are the big announcements, and that kind of brings us full circle to the things that LCV is working on this year with the presidential, the pro-environment majority in the Senate, and improving the pro-environment majority we have in the House already.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. And if you guys want to check out LCV.org right now, you can see me on the homepage with Gary Peters making the endorsement announcement.
How exciting!
It is.
It's hot on the LCV page.
It is hot in here for the listeners. I'm sweating bullets.
It's a radio/sauna, two for the price of one.
Yes, that's great.
You're going to have such a glow.
I think it's surprisingly comfortable in here right now, but that just could be the sauna-like atmosphere that we're usually accustomed to.
We're adapting.
Yeah, we're about to move back into the main station, and they've just now figured out how to not make it dripping, sweating hot in the studio.
We might have to change our name if that happens.
No more slimming down on the show.
Oh, darn. I was looking forward to coming back.
We'll just take over this as the constant hot in here headquarters, and we'll do all our shows.
I like it.
And party in the off time.
Put in a juice bar.
It is a wonderfully intimate environment, all of us sitting around the table here just having our discussions. However, on the subject of hot websites, if you want to check out our own website, wcbn.org/hotinhere. You can listen to podcasts of all of our old shows. You can even, I believe, see a picture of us in the studio if you're curious as to the environment in which we broadcast out of.
Well, in just sort of making a transition to some recent news that shouldn't be that big of an eye-opener for folks out there, but I'm glad people are actually talking about it. We're four women here sitting around a table, and it's hot in here. We care about the climate. But just coming out of Nigeria yesterday, the Minister of Environment, Housing, and Urban Development, Ms. Halima Alayo, basically said yesterday in Abuja that women and children were more vulnerable to the impact of climate change than men and others. She was speaking at a media briefing to mark Earth Day 2008.
Shocker.
Yeah, right? And she is saying that women and children in developing countries will be mostly affected by these effects. They will more heavily impact inhabitants of coastal areas and peasants residing in rural areas that depend on rain-fed activities for survival. Essentially, she's got a pretty good idea of the impacts going on. Specifically in the health sector, increased incidences of malaria, dengue fever, tick-borne diseases, as we were discussing earlier, cholera, diarrhea, and some other diseases, which is a major burden and a major threat to these folks. And women are so intricately involved in producing both food and working with the natural environment to sustain their households. I mean, it's something that we definitely overlook, but this just in, half of the population are actually women.
That ties back to the dam story, too. There's been a lot of work on the extent to which large-scale anthropogenic disturbance of forest ecosystems, as in dams, affects the diversity and circulation of arboviruses, that's arthropod-transmitted viruses, insect vector-borne viruses in general. We talked about Rift Valley earlier in Senegal, but dengue is another one for sure in the family of what we're now discovering to be very dangerous viral elements that can emerge or reemerge in the context of these kinds of transformations of landscapes. And that burden is often borne by women and children. Mm-hmm. And it's, the monitoring, the testing, the availability of drugs. I mean, these are viruses, so drugs are of limited utility anyway. It's really a serious set of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it links the sort of climate change stuff to the more specific interventions that you all were mentioning earlier. I want to give a shout out to people at the SNRE, the School of Natural Resources and Environment here. Dean Bierbaum, Rosina Bierbaum, has been saying for a long time that men, women, and children should wake up about climate change, and there are several interesting faculty discussions going on there now about how do we as a university institution make some constructive contributions to working fast and smart on these issues? I know that Maria Lemos and Arun Agrawal have been working on the concept of adaptive development, which addresses as well this question of institutions, landscapes, vulnerability, both in the context of something like large dams, which are an icon, right, of development in the modernist sense, right? Build a dam, tame nature, that's development, right? So those questions are really linked to the climate stuff that's coming out now and the awareness that institutions, livelihoods, landscapes are very linked and engendered ways on these questions.
That's interesting stuff, and I've been doing a bit of reading also on how political changes influence crops that are grown, particularly in Ethiopia, with encouraging of maize as a cultivar and a major food source. And we've been touching on maize in past shows, but essentially you can get two crops of maize in a single year, so it makes a lot of sense if you have some concern about the availability of your land in the future to grow it. But maize also provides an ideal environment for malaria larvae to feed off of. So malaria has spread in the country in places that it hasn't been before, simply because of the production of maize and all of these other things going on. So,
right, welcome to biofuel world, my friend. Too.
Oh,
maize,
we're living in it now.
Cane. Absolutely, absolutely.
It's amazing. Food, the subject of food and the connections to agricultural production, between agricultural production and sort of environmental and social outcomes, we've been discussing, I believe, for the past 2 or 3 weeks on the show, rising world food prices. And it's amazing to me how quickly the whole biofuels issue has become linked in a lot of people's minds. And it's certainly, I imagine there's a lot of concrete evidence for this, between what we choose to do with our crops, whether we grow them for biofuels, whether we grow them for animal consumption, whether we grow them for human consumption, and these food riots and more or less uprisings that are taking place across the developing world. And the food prices we're seeing increasing here in the grocery store in the developed world. So it's amazing to me how quickly that's become an issue. You know, Fidel Castro and some others who are believed to be on the, or who are on, I guess, the fringe left sort of made those predictions a year ago, and everyone said, maybe. And within a year, we're seeing that come to fruition. Yeah. So it's amazing.
One of
how quickly
part of
that's
my
happened.
Job at LCV is actually interviewing candidates, you know, that with an eye towards endorsement, and I vet them on a number of issues, a whole range of environmental issues, before that policy degree from Asinari comes in handy.
Glad to hear it, Karen.
Yeah. So get out of there and get a job.
Yeah.
But one of the things that has come up in some of the interviews that I've been doing is biofuels, and it's amazing to see the spectrum of education on that particular issue as it applies to domestic resources in terms of, you know, converting it to biofuel for cars and whatever. So I went to a conference, actually. I saw Tom Prinsen, another professor at Asinari, out in D.C. Gosh,
absolutely.
You know,
like, on the climate change stuff, he's really doing interesting work as well. Yeah.
And they've published on, you know, the false promise of biofuels.
Right.
But
right.
There's still a lot of education that needs to be done, particularly for, you know, federal candidates, people who are going to go in and make decisions, at least for the U.S.
Yep. Don Scavia, Joan Nassauer, the dead zone stuff, the link between Midwestern agriculture, corn production, and what we see in the Gulf of Mexico. Lots of work that needs to be brought together and made more accessible to people so they understand these causal links.
Yeah. And it's tough, I think, for a lot of people without the background knowledge that we are lucky to get at SNRE, and to be able to see through some of the tricky parts of these issues. Biofuel sounds like a great idea. Dams produces clean energy, you know, but there are these unintended consequences associated with them. And we certainly need to work hard to get those messages out.
Yeah, there was a conference at the School of Environment a few years back on climate justice and the whole idea that this was, I think, 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Or five, yeah. You know, it was a while back, and they were saying, is it possible that the burden of costs of climate change might be unduly borne by the poor, by women, by children? You know, so it really is one of those things where you're right to say, this just in, can this possibly just be coming in? That these kinds of social asymmetries are going to really mean a lot in the world we're heading into, and they're going to be increasingly pronounced effects for the poor and for the more vulnerable socially. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, Gina, you were saying that for people without the kind of background we do in environmental, or we have in environmental issues, it's sort of difficult to disentangle all of these complexities.
Or perhaps that politics needs a clear answer, or that people want a black and white sort of answer.
Absolutely.
May I just pitch in on that and say that being one of the people that the elite engaged in the SNRE milieu, I find it very difficult to disentangle all these.
Thank you. That was exactly the point I was about to make. I am constantly confused by these issues, and if there's one thing I think my grad school education has taught me, I really can't speak today, is that the law of unintended consequences is always operating in the world, and it's just really hard to try and formulate policies. And I think biofuels is probably the best example in recent years we can come up with of that's, you know, sounds like a great idea, and yet there's all of these repercussions that people don't see until perhaps it's too late. But coming back to the biofuels issue on the domestic side, Carrie, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this. We talked about this in the past couple of weeks, like I said. There was a story, though, that I didn't get a chance to elaborate on as fully as I would have liked, and that's about how the increased biofuels production is causing farmers in the U.S. to take land that was previously in the Conservation Reserve Program, which is part of the Farm Bill, the United States Farm Bill, which more or less controls farm and food policy for our country. And the current version has expired, and I believe the next one is still languishing in Congress. It was supposed to be passed in 2007, but is still kicking around. But because of the rising prices for crops, and because farmers can make so much more money growing for biofuels, they've been taking their land out of the Conservation Reserve Program.
What is up with that?
I know. So, again, we see these unintended consequences. And is there, what kind of work is LCV doing on that front?
Well, you mentioned the Farm Bill, and it's actually something that we scored in 2007. And if I may, I'll read from our scorecard, which folks can visit at lcv.org/scorecard. It's actually an issue that I'm not steeped in. I mean, we spend a lot of time on energy and global warming, but we obviously are looking at all the legislation that goes through. So, in 2007, anyway, because farmers, ranchers, and private forest landowners control over half of the U.S. landscape, they have a significant impact on our air, water, and quality and wildlife habitat. And unfortunately, traditional farmer subsidies, which soak up over half of all farm spending, encourage overproduction on environmentally sensitive areas. And roughly 2 out of 3 landowners who want to enlist in voluntary conservation programs are turned away because of insufficient program funds. And the Farm Bill is the largest source of conservation funding in America. And its reauthorization every 5 years gives Congress a chance to reform the U.S. farm policy in ways that enhance our environment. And during 2007, the consideration of the Farm Bill, two representatives offered an amendment to make the farm subsidy system more equitable and to boost conservation funding by $3 billion, but the amendment failed. So I actually don't know enough about the politics around that particular issue, but if folks want to visit the scorecard and check it out and see, again, how their representative voted, they can look at it that way.
You know, I hate to keep bringing this back to NPR, because really, what can they do next to WCBN's It's Hot In Here coverage, right? I mean, it's hot in here, but did you hear the story this morning that was about the Midwest just getting so much hotter so much faster than, or the Western U.S. getting so much hotter so much faster than any of the rest of the planet, really? And people sort of going, let's just grow more monocropped maize fields and see how that works out with the whole, like, West getting much hotter than any place else. It's really interesting to think about how, you know, those causal links are going to stack up. And
well, I was talking about policies that seem like good ideas, but then turn out to be maybe not so good ideas. But then there are policies that are bad ideas from the start and prove to be even worse than perhaps people had thought. And I think that might be one of those.
Could qualify.
Yeah.
Well, and back to this issue of climate change being more damaging than we initially thought. This came out actually a few weeks ago. We didn't get a chance to discuss it. But Nicholas Stern, who did the fabulous Stern Report, putting out some serious estimates and costs of what mitigating against climate change will cost us and how we can find ways to adapt. He actually has come out and said several weeks ago that emissions are growing much faster than we thought, so that the problem is going to be more significant than he even initially thought in his report.
And his initial report was quite terrifying, so I don't know where he's coming up with these nightmare scenarios that are worse than
Stern
what he
report.
Originally put
Google
out.
It if you haven't read it. Yeah.
Well, you have to remember we still have non-believers out there.
Good heavens.
And they're in Congress.
And they are in Congress.
So, yeah, that's also frightening. Well, Gina, I think we need to go back to a musical number to get our spirits up for
okay.
the end of the show.
Excellent.
We're wandering into dangerous territory.
Well, yes.
I'm starting to despair. Could you hit me with a dance tune, please?
Yeah, I wish I had a dance. There's really a song. Perhaps this is a dance song. This one is actually going out to my gal, Muna Yilma, who is hopefully listening in Washington, D.C. This is an Astor Awecki song, who is from Ethiopia. I believe believe it's called Eshuru or something. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but if I am, give us a call at 734-763-3500 and set us straight. Here we go.
It's hot.
Shut up.
enjoyed that tune. It's certainly a favorite of mine. And going back, actually, the gal Muna, who is a big fan of Aster, was kind enough to let us know that the Silent Tsunami, actually, is the headline article of The Economist this week. Do check it out. You can check it out online at economist.com. But it's all about the food crisis and how to solve it. So there are some folks thinking about some solutions out there, which is quite exciting for those of us who like solutions. So, people eat food.
Well, yeah, you're
segue- this just in. This breaking news all over this program today. 50% of the population is women, and people eat food.
That's probably the best segue we've ever had on the show.
Without a doubt. So, talking about food, and specifically in an African context, I wanted to get to a couple of issues that are also getting a lot of play in the media these days. One is overfishing and the overexploitation of fisheries, especially in West Africa, which is due... well, obviously, like anything we talk about on the show, it's complex. There's a lot of factors going into it. But a lot of it is this foreign fleet fishing of industrialized trawlers, especially heavily subsidized ones from the European Union that move into West African coastal waters and fish, take out a lot of fish. And it's believed that the biomass in that fishery has declined by a factor of 13, some say by 50%. There's different numbers going around, but there's no doubt that it's very significant. And obviously, this has huge impacts on the coastal people and people even in the interior of coastal countries who depend on fish as a significant source of protein.
I'm sorry, but this makes me so angry.
Yeah, it should. And not only does it seem initially like a very bad idea, but it's the countries that they're paid. They're called cash for access agreements. And not only are the European Union countries and now increasingly Asian countries as well just paying straight up cash to governments, which, as we've talked about, tends to accumulate there and doesn't necessarily trickle down to people who need it. But they don't pay them very much in terms of for the actual value of the fish that they're taking out of their waters. And not only that, but that fish gets exported for the most part straight to Europe. And again, going back to these sort of gendered issues and gender dynamics, that hurts not only the fishermen in the water who tend to be men, but the people who traditionally process and sell the fish at market in West Africa, which is overwhelmingly women. Mm-hmm. But talking about protein needs and markets in West Africa, this connects. There's been increasingly fascinating research that has showed that this issue of overfishing is connecting quite strongly with what is known as bushmeat hunting. And perhaps, Rebecca, you are quite literally an expert on this issue, do a lot of work about it all over the world. So could you mm-hmm. talk mm-hmm. a little bit about bushmeat, what that term even means, and what's going on with that issue?
Sure. It's interesting to segue into it from the fishery stuff. The fishery stuff has gotten a lot of attention, I think, just last week. Didn't we have a screening or 2 weeks ago of the Darwin's Nightmare mm-hmm. film here on campus, which is the sort of really dramatic narrative about not just coastal fisheries, but even lake fisheries in Africa being sort of literally airlifted out, mismanaged to produce fillets and airlifted out. So it's a really traumatic set of issues that are really linked to the idea that globalization, intensification of trade, and growth in infrastructure, uneven growth in infrastructure, causes these kinds of booms and busts mm-hmm. in not just, you know, mineral resources or timber resources, but in faunal and fisheries resources. And that's something that's been coming for a long time. The bushmeat trade, the bushmeat term, is a very African term, although it refers to the unsustainable and often illegal use of wild game meat. Mm. And it is a description of, it's used often in conjunction with the word crisis, the bushmeat crisis. And that phrase is used to describe the very high and rising rates of noncompliance with codes within countries to protect certain species and certain levels of offtake so that wild game species can continue to be productive into the future. So for a long time, for me, when I was getting interested in these issues during my own Peace Corps and field research for my doctoral work time, you know, when I was spending time in the forests and savannas of Central Africa, I was seeing the importance of hunting not only for subsistence, for families to feed protein to their kids, of various kinds, from large antelope to tiny bush rats to, you know, all kinds of species are eaten. There's very little waste. Mm-hmm. But even with such an efficient and, in those ways, sustainable set of practices in place, the increasing demand for bushmeat in urban areas that are growing and beyond the African continent, urban areas within Europe and even the U.S., has driven a kind of export market for bushmeat, which has been increasingly, we've seen increasing numbers, quantities of bushmeat in airplanes within Africa and between Africa and North America and Europe. And the sort of frontier side of that back in the forests and savannas of Africa is sort of embodied for me by rural residents, cousins or friends or acquaintances who show up for the summer with coolers and bike cables and ammunition and guns and just, they hunt, they strap flashlights on their heads and they hunt at night. It's a fantastic way to make ends meet, whether for your own family subsistence or for cash. And those two uses together are proving unsustainable for a lot of species. We're seeing local extinctions. We're seeing that kind of hunting facilitated by inattention through logging and mining to the way that trucks and roads are being used to transport the meat. So it really is quite serious. Now, the research, as you mentioned, Gwen, is getting better. Our sense of the numbers is getting better. It's hard to back it all up really carefully because these are difficult things to document. Elizabeth Bennett and John Robinson of the Wildlife Conservation Society published in 2000 some figures that were shocking, saying that, you know, hunting is unsustainable in 50% of the cases in Bolivia, 70% in Sulawesi, and almost 100% in Central African Republic, my field site. So that there are, you know, real concerns. Up to 94% of the animals that are getting snared in these cable snares can rot before hunters get back to check the snares.
90%?
Can you imagine? Well, you have to remember, this is a criminalized activity. It's dangerous to lay the snares. It's dangerous to check them. You have to make sure you're not getting intersected by patrols. And you lay a lot more than you can actually harvest because that's just, you know, the way it works. And so up to 90%, 25% being average of what gets lost in snare hunting, right? So that's a really, really wasteful system. In fact, when you move into the sort of more intensive commercial trade, and this is really different from the way that, for example, forest foragers like pygmies hunted traditionally in communities with woven nets where they would encircle an area, flush game out, would run into the circular net, and they would beat the game and divide the game into portions on the spot, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of hermetic nature of that, right, where you're hunting in zones or in patches in communities that include women and children actively in the hunt. This kind of commercial trade can often be much more male-dominated at the level of the actual hunting. Although market women have really important roles to play in furnishing ammunition and trafficking the meat in and out of areas. It's a huge part of making ends meet for rural populations who are struggling, and it is a really complicated set of issues, but one that is of increasing concern.
It's incredible, though. Some of the footage I've seen is how intensely militarized this, the entire, not only on the hunter side, has become, but as this often, as you said, takes place in protected areas, the game wardens and the folks in the parks who are looking out for these animals. But I mean, it's literally almost like a warlike situation, and it's quite amazing to me how, when you think about, you know, poaching and how that's just become so militarized and warlike. And
yeah, so. as many things have become militarized and warlike.
Sure.
But it's, you know, yeah, I have a doctoral student, Leslie, really brave woman, living with her two kids under five and her husband in Central African Republic now, and her her blog, which I'll be happy to post on your website if people
Please.
Are interested. Her posts in the past couple of weeks have included some very worrisome some figures, some 10 armed poachers shooting into the tourist sailings from the tourist miradors, from the tourist observation towers in Central African Republic's parks, killing three elephants last week. The Central African Army is committed to sending in forces to help with the interrogation and capture of poachers. But you're right, this is... And many of the anti-poaching hands who have experienced throughout the colonial era, throughout the post-colonial era in Africa, will laugh at you and say, what did you think this was about, my dear? It's been a long time that anti-poaching in African contexts has been a militarized and not a very pretty activity. And it's a real shame that those legacies are the ones that are continuing here. These days, I would even say that food security for future generations of Africa and Africans is taking an increasing backseat to the idea of sort of homeland and international security, and the idea that bushmeat can carry diseases and it can be linked to the traffic in arms and people. And there's a kind of bolstering now of concern about border security and patrol and enforcement, which is unfortunately consonant with those old colonial coercive conservation legacies, as Nancy Peluso has called them in her writing. So it's a hard moment on these issues, but one where, you know, again, the stakes are high and the wildlife populations are pretty fragile.
Yeah, it's incredible how these issues are so intensely linked to each other. And on the subject of links and getting back to the overexploitation of fisheries a little bit, there's some really fascinating research that's come out. I believe the University of California, Berkeley, and perhaps some other institutions as well, that has shown they've done intensive research in the West African markets, and they've shown that there is a very strong correlation between the amount of fish that is available and the amount of bushmeat that is sold in the market, and that there is generally a very strong inverse relationship, which is when there is fish available, people will generally buy that as their first choice, that is the traditional source of protein, and won't buy bushmeat quite as much. But when fish are, when there's a lesser supply of fish, bushmeat will increasingly move into the market. But as bushmeat has moved into the market, the demand has increased. And as you were saying, Rebecca, there's also now an export-oriented market for bushmeat as well. But it goes to show that they're between two environmental problems that don't seem very linked, fisheries and bushmeat hunting, there is, in fact, a linkage, and that once the two have sort of become linked and together, you add in export markets, and the issue sort of takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, absolutely, a life of its own, and it also is something that we are seeing not just in Africa but elsewhere. Southeast Asia is now full of hotlines and enforcement mechanisms. Kristen Sumrall, a CBN initiate, has done some work on that, and I think it's something that we need to get smarter about cross-regionally and also within the African context in terms of the specific governance challenge and human security challenges that it raises. It's going to be a very different world with respect to these ecologies of subsistence and the availability of protein from wild game for our children and our children's children. It really will.
Well, speaking of Kristen Sumrall, she has actually left us a delightful, well, I'm not sure if it's delightful, but I would imagine it is if she left it in the studio, a little album. And maybe, Hugh, you can tell
Get
us a little bit more about
out.
It.
Sumrall left us an album.
She's so cool.
Right. Some of you may know, some of our radio listeners may know Kristen better as the DJ of Hot Pants every Friday afternoon at 3.
Tight Pants.
Oh, I always get it wrong. Tight Pants, which in all honesty is the greatest rock show on modern American radio.
I agree.
And this is not rock. It's on one of those child-sized platters. So I can only assume that it's going to be something other than her usual. But we'll just press the button.
Do you know
what it's
called? What's it called?
It's called The World's Tallest Pygmy.
Oh, how appropriate. Yes. Good
and
heavens.
Here goes nothing.
Sir, I understand you're the world's tallest pygmy. Is that true?
Yes. I'm 5'6" in my stocking feet.
But you were not always that tall, right?
No. It was only after I drank the gorilla milk that I became the greatest basketball player in all the Pygmies.
Gorilla milk?
Yes, from the African cow.
From an African cow?
Yes, he's the one that goes, mow, mow.
Mow, mow. Funny. Funny, funny. Tell me about the cannibals. Do they always eat with their fingers?
No, they always eat their fingers separately.
Separately? You are a funny little...
Here, have a sip of gorilla meal.
No, thank you, no thank you. I noticed that you don't have a spear. Why is that?
Oh, I lost it in a poker game.
You're in the jungle?
Yes, I was playing with a cheetah.
With a cheetah?
Here, have a sip of gorilla meal.
No, thank you. Say, if you're a pygmy, how do you protect yourself from all of those ferocious animals?
Oh, I'm very brave.
And what do you do with the charging rhino?
You take away his charge account.
Well, how about the lions and the tigers?
Oh, I have the African blowgun.
A blowgun?
Yes, I blow the poison darts at the animals.
And when you run out of darts?
Then I blow. Here, have a sip of gorilla milk.
No, thank you.
It's very hairy. It will make you go eat.
Well, it does look good, and I am thirsty. Here's looking up at you. No offense. Hey, that is good. Hey, that tastes great. You know,
I'm going to go out and buy some of this right away. I'll have a whole glass. Can I finish the rest of it? I'll just have a little more, and then a little more, and then a little more.
Congratulations. You are now the world's smallest announcer.
What an know about you folks, but I'm thirsty for some gorilla milk.
That's like the Lewis Carroll goes to the Congo, like, drink me kind of formula. It's crazy. Somebody was on some strong stuff when they recorded that one. But, you know, it's a really funny thing to think about how much these stereotypes of Africa and Africans, I mean, we're talking about African resources, right? We're talking about African food resources and energy resources. We're not even dealing with the way that Africa itself has been a resource for some of the worst humor and stereotyping in the history, and how getting beyond those cultural issues, too, is playing into a lot of these environmental problem-solving issues. Like, at what point do we see, and this is really interesting, because right now there's this kind of political movement in the Congo where pygmies, quote-unquote, as a kind of political identity, are gaining ground. They've got a lot of relationships to NGOs. They're asserting territorial claims for the first time in ways that look a little more like indigenous movements in Latin America or Southeast Asia. So, you know, that kind of thing that we just heard is really off the wall, but it's also indicative of a world where pygmies are an emblem of this kind of outside of time thing, and that's changed. You know, that'll be an interesting thing to watch play out on all these issues: dams, climate change, food, and hunting.
If you're interested more in that, the National Geographic Africa series actually has a, I think, almost an hour-long segment on the pygmy issue, a group of folks that are coming out of the forest to make claims to their land because there are some loggers that came in. It's quite interesting.
Right, right. That stuff, it's getting hot in there is what's happening in the Congo Basin right now in ways that'll be really interesting to track, and I wanted to just thank you guys for bringing it to the attention of our listeners and for inviting me onto the show today.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your wealth of knowledge and eloquent ways of conveying all this information that you do hold, and for having such a fabulous radio voice.
You do indeed. And another thing I want to bring up is that we make a point of it on this program to not always roll around in the mud of depression and doom and gloom that can sort of permeate so many of these environmental and social discussions, for good reason. However, I have to say, Rebecca, one of the things I love most about you is the fact that you take even that song, which we're all saying, what the heck are we going to do with this? And you say, this is a wonderful thing because it is a teaching opportunity. And we're going to talk about how this ridiculous song is going to illuminate in very, very coherent ways a lot of the issues that we've been talking about here on this program. So that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you can't take yourself too seriously.
No, indeed you can't. And we don't. So it's fine.
Well, thank you also for Carrie Dugan for coming on into the studio.
So good to see her.
Thanks for heating it up in here.
Thanks
for
having me.
And I'm going to take a bit of a hiatus, maybe for a month and a half, but hopefully Gwen will continue to give you all the environmental news that's fit for you to hear, and then we'll be back sometime in some other time.
We're going to be traveling, but we'll have maybe a couple editions of the show, and Gina, good luck in Africa.
Thank you. It's going to be a great time. I'm excited.
All right.
As you should be.
I wish... Pardon me. Okay. Never mind. Go ahead.
Oh, Hugh has wishes that he wants to share with us, but he's unable to due to technological difficulties. So thank you so much for...
Okay.
Oh, he's back. Hey.
Yeah, you think
hey.
I would know. Yeah, I just make the point that we probably won't be around regularly during the summer months. However, when we do come on, we'll be on here and again, and we'll announce it ahead of time on the blog. And also, all the audio will be available constantly on the main website, which is...
WCBN.org/hotinhere.
That's right.
Nice work.
Hey.
Nice work. And that'll redirect you to Hugh's site, which he so generously allowed us to post our show on.
Indeed.
So if you miss us, you miss hearing about us, you miss our rockin' tunes, check us out on the internets. All right, I'm going to take you out on a song called
Speaking
African
Queen. Speaking of a rockin' tune, this song will be stuck in your head for days. I guarantee it. But it's a wonderful, wonderful song to have stuck in your head.
It is infectious. Also by an East African man who calls himself Two-Faced Idabia. I remember... finally finding out who sang this song when having some waiting for some maize actually to be cooked for us that we got from some farmers who are both farming fish and farming maize in a town called Karatu. So rock on. Here we go, African Queen. We'll see you next time. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Carrie. Thank you, Hugh. Thank you, Gwen.
Yeah, yeah. You are my African queen. Just like the sun lights up the earth, it lights up my life. The only one I ever see with a smile so bright. Hey, and just yesterday, you came around my way. You changed my horse in a way.
astonishing beauty. Oh, you couldn't make a brother sing. No ordinary thing, a supernatural being. And no, you are brighter than the moon, brighter than the star. I love you just the way you are. And you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been, yeah. You make my heart go ding-a-ling-a-ling. Oh, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty, yeah. Stand as one, the outstanding one. I look into your eyes, girl, what I see is paradise. Hey, you captivated my soul. Now every day I want you more. I cannot deny this feeling I'm feeling inside. No one cannot take your place. You cannot take your space. And it's a fact I cannot erase. And no, you are the one that makes me smile. Make me float like a boat upon the Nile. Girl, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been. You make my heart go ding-a-ling-a-ling. Yeah, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty. Oh, you are my African queen, and I know, oh yes I know. You are my African queen, and I know. See, I know what I am feeling in my heart and in my soul. Oh, I know that it's this love, and I know that this love was surely sent from up above. Cause you're the only one that I think of. You are my African queen, and I know that this means that you're the only one that I will serve. I'll give you my heart, my love, my body and my money. Every other thing you think of. In a man, who could think of anything better than you? Who could think of ever hurting you? Sacrifice my all, I'll give it all to you. You are my African queen, for real. You are my African queen, the girl of my dream, the girl of my dream. You may have never been. Oh, na na, yeah. Oh, la, la. You are my African queen. I love you, oh yeah, my African.